It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. And it's time for the Fastest 15, starting with the brand new, you've been waiting for it, I'm sure, waiting to pour $1,000 or more toward a new iPhone 12 Pro or 12 Pro Max. Apple is announcing the newest revisions to its popular phone line. This time, the screen's even bigger. You're going to have to use both hands to use your phone. It's a 6.1-inch and 6.7-inch screen, stainless steel case designs, and LiDAR sensors, and there's 5G connectivity. So unless you're in the conspiracy that 5G is going to melt your brain, you're going to be excited about this phone. I look at this phone, and you know what really impressed me? If they had an iPhone 12 that actually had a phone charger that kept working, you know, and it didn't automatically self-destruct, that's the modification I'd like to see to the iPhone. Most. I've used iPhones forever, and I love it. I think it's super functional. It seems great. And yet I look over at you Android users that are paying a fraction of the cost for the phone, and I'm a little jealous. And I think if I would have started with that operating system, I never picked this up. But since I'm stuck with the iPhone operating system and I've used it forever, you know, I can pick up my dad's phone, which is not that, and I don't even know how to answer it. So I'm stuck, and I look at this and I think, yes, now I want one of these. And it's a bit embarrassing to admit.
I definitely want one of these.
Yeah, but what's it going to run? You know what I mean? I mean, it's like investing in a car.
Well, I've been waiting a long time, so I think I'm due for an upgrade. So I'm hoping I get a deal. Oh.
You should be in the average. You deserve it, Nicole. It doesn't matter how much it is. You deserve it.
It's, my current phone, I have to talk on with a headphones because the speaker doesn't hear me correctly. So I have to use headphones to talk on it. So I need it. I need it, Dave.
Yes. I think you deserve it. Honestly. So the iPhone 12 starts at just $999. That's with 128 gigabytes of storage. I didn't remember when my desktop had 1 gigabyte of storage and I thought I was really doing something. Now it's 128 gigabytes of storage, and the iPhone 12 Max Pro Max is going to start at $1,099.
Oh my gosh! And you can start pre-ordering. I'm not spending that much on it.
Are you going to pre-order at all? I mean, the key to me is you just wait till your cell phone provider says, "Hey, we got a special deal." If you're going to stick with them anyway, you know, you can buy it cheaper, and then you know
that's what I'll do.
Right? Yeah. So. Anyway, but wouldn't you agree with me that the top change of the phone isn't necessarily screen size? Because I'm not sure the extra half inch is really the key here. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's nice. I like the big screen. Most people that I know prefer the smaller ones because they can't grip it in their hand as well. But the thing that drives me crazy
is... I like being able to put it in my pocket. It drives me crazy not being able to put it in my pocket.
No,
but do you remember when the smaller the phone, the better? Isn't it funny how much done a 180 on that. Now it's the bigger the phone, the better. I mean, we're going to be carrying around tablets. There are tablets. If you want a big phone, just tablets.
Yeah. And what's the difference between this and at some point you're going to say, wait a second, we've got a 13-inch iPhone 14? You know, I mean, at what point is it just a tablet that's also a phone? Anyway, they want to make sure that you don't confuse the two because they want you to buy both. I mean, that's really the key, keeping that money flowing. So hopefully nobody takes a look at, I mean, I don't know if they've still got I don't know if they've got facilities in China. They had some fairly controversial facilities there at some point. I'm looking forward to those stories coming out again, just to see how Apple's doing when it comes to corporate responsibility for that score. Don't feel guilty, though, buying your phone, Nicole. I mean, I don't want that. So buy your phone before that story comes out so that you can say, well, now that I have the phone, I'm stuck with it. I got to roll with it. Speaking of stuck with, Joe Biden running for the Senate, I say stuck with because let's face it, even if you're really calling for Joe, it's not like, you know, you were desperate for Biden. He was just kind of the guy you thought would be the best bet at beating Trump, right? I mean, I have yet to meet anybody who is saying Joe Biden was my number one choice for all time. And I'm just so excited. He's such an innovative thinker. And he's the man for the times. I get a better sense that, you know, I meet a lot of people who say, I really want Joe Biden to win because I don't like Trump. That's the story. But Joe Biden's not even sure which office he's running for these days. You can chalk it up to his memory, or you can chalk it up to just being on the road the whole time and maybe being a little tired. But Biden gaffed up yet again.
You know, we have to come together. That's why I'm running. I'm running as a proud Democrat for the Senate.
Yes, for the Senate. A little embarrassing at that point, and especially that he didn't correct himself. But then he kind of adds to that by not remembering the name of, oh, you know, that guy he ran against. What was his name? That guy, the governor from and the senator from Utah. What's his name?
You may remember I got in trouble when we were running against the senator who was a Mormon, the governor. Okay.
So, you know, that Mormon guy. What? Geez. Can you imagine, by the way, if Trump tried to pull that kind of thing? That if Trump had said, I was running against, and he was just trying to gather it up and just identified somebody by their religion or something, there would be all kinds of commotion. Anyway, so Biden can't remember Romney and is running for the Senate. Let's face it, he ran for the Senate, you know, for what? I mean, he was a senator for, what, 47 years or some god-awful amount of time. So he's used to saying that. So there's a certain amount of me that I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt in terms of rote memory. You know, you just say something over and over and over again, and these guys are on the campaign trail repeating the same talking points over and over and over again. Biden was trying to change it up there with a little current events, and he fumbles the ball, which is not an unusual thing for Joe Biden, and probably is part of the reason why people feel kind of stuck with him. And then Biden also pointed out that there's a lot of the country that probably shouldn't vote for him at all.
Gallup reported last week 56% of Americans said that they were better off today than they were 4 years ago and would have been under the Obama-Biden administration. So why should people who feel that they are better off today under the Trump administration vote for you?
Well, if they think that, they probably shouldn't.
So the poll was 56% of the people polled said that they were better off under the Trump administration than they were under the Obama-Biden administration. So, you know, why should people switch to you? Instead of talking about his vision for the future and what he was going to accomplish or some of the unique challenges maybe that the Obama-Biden administration has, his response is, well, they probably shouldn't vote for me. I mean, I don't need that 56%. So it's been a weird 48 hours for Joe Biden's campaign. And, of course, Donald Trump was very quick to latch on to that and became a little weird himself.
Now, Biden had a bad day. He forgot Mitt Romney's name. He didn't know what state he was in. And he said today he's a proud Democrat running for the U.S. Senate. No, you can't.
All right. So here's the thing about Trump, though. You know, that stuff's kind of funny. It's good to slam your opponent and all that. I get it. That's what people expect. But I feel like Trump's already won that crowd. You know, for the people that really want to see him, you know, do the political equivalent of a big time wrestling body slam on Joe Biden. They've seen that thing and they've had their fill of that. And yeah, you'll get cheers on that. But for Trump, that's the expected. It would be more interesting, I think, if he did the unexpected. You know, he could point it out and then say something completely or approach it in a completely different manner. And you know, because his appeal is lacking in areas that, you know, he doesn't need that kind of approach to appeal to. I mean, his numbers have declined among women, particularly the suburban women. And so the whole slamming, you know, Biden thing, it works for those who are already excited about Trump, but at some point, you know, you want to shake it up and try and appeal on a broader scale. I say things like that, but then again, Trump won beyond all expectations before. Polling is roughly the same as it was back in 2016. Everybody thinks he's going to lose. In fact, I saw today a big story, you know, the Joe Biden landslide is there. And maybe that's going to happen. Maybe that's true. It's possible. Certainly it should be Biden's to lose because, well, you know, actually it's Trump's to lose because people are, I think, are making the choice Trump or not Trump. And what Trump wants is a choice between Biden and Trump, you know, and the more he can make that the issue, the more scrutiny Biden's position gets and the more people start to wonder, you know, what direction they should go. And it becomes, you know, a challenge unto itself. So Biden, again, you know, he's struggling. Trump jumps on top of that stuff and rolls with it. But then he starts talking about, you know, his feelings of immortality now that he's cured of COVID. He's feeling a lot of love for everybody in the audience.
I'll kiss the guys and the beautiful women and everybody. I'll just give you a big fat kiss.
I think there's a majority of people in Seattle and Portland that consider that a weapon of mass destruction. You know, the threat of Trump walking through the audience and giving everybody a big fat wet kiss. Guys and gals, no different in Trump's sight. He's ready to give you a big smooch. Can you imagine the horror in so many places? Oh my gosh. But anyway, he was talking about how he felt really healthy. He's now that he's been through COVID, he's ready to roll again and wants people to face things head on. It's funny how negative so many want to make that message. And I'm all for people being cautious, for watching out for people with vulnerabilities, but you know, people insulting that message. I wonder, what do you want, a fear-mongering message? You want to shut things down? Do you not think there's other consequences to people being too afraid, you know, which are very clear, both in terms of mental health and economic health and other things? So, you know, it's I thought it was a solid thing. I thought it was an inspiring thing in some ways. All right, speaking of inspiring, CNN's Jim Acosta is reporting that Trump supporters were inspired by him, inspired so much that they had to chant his name.
And as this crowd is chanting that there are members of the press here who suck, I should also point out, Wolf, what also sucks, getting the coronavirus.
Oh, you got to leave it to Acosta. He's always ready with a zinger, ready to go after him. I saw this story, a write-up about this thing. You know, Acosta was just on his game. I mean, this was just solid stuff from CNN. I thought, you know, part of the problem, though, is Acosta he's very clearly has animus toward the president. Very clearly, you know, and you might say he's got every reason to. You might dislike him. But at the same time, you know, the impression of impartiality is easily lost. And, you know, I've long said I don't like it when reporters and others pretend that they have no biases. Because, of course, these are people that are steeped in news. They're going to have their own opinions about people and places. They've been educated. They're involved in politics. They care about the world. So they should have a point of view. You know, Jim Lehrer was kind of famous from public television for never voting because he didn't want to bias himself. And I thought, this is just crazy. Of course you have an opinion. Everybody knows you have an opinion. So go ahead and do that. The problem I have is when people won't acknowledge their opinion and won't acknowledge their bias. And so if you acknowledge your bias, then you can see, well, maybe I'm avoiding a question or I don't want certain information to get an emphasis because I'm afraid my own side will lose. You know, that's where you challenge yourself and provide an objective coverage, you know, objective approach. I once hosted an event, a debate with Ben Shapiro and Shama Sawant, you know, and at the end, Shama Sawant and her staff thought that they said they were extremely pleased with how fair I was in terms of moderating, you know, and that was either, you know, a great compliment or a great insult, depending on your point of view, I guess. But, you know, the point is, it shouldn't be that hard to recognize, okay, I'm coming from it from this conservative perspective. What kinds of questions would somebody on the far left ask? And you just read it. You know, it's a great benefit of the English language and the ability of the written word to bring us, you know, together and to be able to empathize and to understand the point of view of somebody else. So Jim Acosta, he managed to slam the audiences, but at the same time, he kind of ends up slamming CNN too, because I find that network to be particularly difficult to watch. Kind of miss the days. He said recently, what was it he said? There was nothing. He's never been ashamed of the CNN network. And I thought, you've never watched New Year's Eve specials on CNN, have you? Because if you have, and you can still say there's nothing shameful about CNN, well, then it's all on you. That's for sure. And Americans are stressed out, but it's not COVID-19 that's the most stressful. The most stressful comes from moving. Fox News reporting on a new survey showing that Americans find moving more stressful than divorce or having kids. Now, isn't that's just bizarre to me. But they just said, look, the whole thing is a struggle. And what I thought was most interesting was that they found that moving the furniture was among the most stressful parts. And they thought that it was overwhelmingly, like 94%, said it was worth it to hire somebody to help them move, even though the price tag was high. And the price tag seems to be a part of the move. Finances, also, by the way, a very high incidence of divorce due to financial considerations. But anyway, $1,500 is the average cost. But as somebody who's moved furniture over and over again, I could relate to this idea that moving the furniture in between doorways and up and down stairs is extremely stressful because you're trying not to bang anything. You know you're going to have to fix it if you do. You know, whether you have an apartment or a house, you know, if you're moving, you're probably going to sell the house. You're going to have to fix it. If it's an apartment, you want your damage deposit. You're trying to move these huge things over. And every part of me always wonders, why don't we just make doorways about 2 inches wider, right? Or couches an inch narrower? But it's always this, you've got like a fraction of a centimeter space between them, and then you're supposed to move this furniture. It's like there's these sadistic architects, you know, that get together and say, you know what we got to do? We got to make these doorways just narrow enough to make it almost impossible to get the couch through. They're going to have to get the legs through or take the legs off the couch and then put them back on. It's going to be hilarious. And then we're going to make the staircases narrow enough with a little post that that hangs off the ceiling, a header that makes it just narrow enough so they're going to have to get almost crouched to the floor and to get it down to the bottom of the stairs. And then it's going to just kind of wedge there, and they're going to have to really, really push it. I mean, is that not everyone's moving experience? Nicole, back me up there. It's a nightmare, isn't it? No, she's gone.
Moving is definitely the most stressful, yes. But then I also don't have children. So I don't know if I could compare that to children and divorce, because I know of some people that have had some pretty stressful divorces. So I don't know if I quite buy this, because divorce, it doesn't look fun.
Yeah, we talked to the guy earlier who was shot 9 times, allegedly, by the hired assassins from his ex-wife. That would rank as more stressful than this.
A little bit.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Seattle is getting high accolades for being a clean, green city, something that Seattle politicians love to tout. The governor has made himself kind of an Al Gore replacement for a new generation in terms of being a symbol for the environment and having the Emerald City, the jewel of Washington State, be ranked just behind New York in terms of clean energy progress as a jewel in the crown of the environmental movement in Washington State, or is it? Here to talk about what's happening with the environment in Seattle is Todd Myers, my colleague at Washington Policy Center and my normal job. Todd Myers is the director of the Center for the Environment at Washington Policy Center. Thanks so much for making the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You bet. So Seattle ranks number 2 in this study. First of all, tell us about the study. What are they measuring? And, you know, what does it mean to say Seattle's number 2 for clean energy progress?
Yeah, so it's a national organization that promotes clean energy policy, and they ranked all the cities on a 101-point scale about whether their policies would reduce CO2 emissions and things like that. What was interesting to me, though, is that of the 101 points, only 4 actually measured whether you reduced CO2 emissions effectively in the real world. All of the other points were related to adopting certain policies or even things like do you have enough staffing in your planning department? Unrelated to whether you're actually making a difference in the world. So Seattle ranks second nationwide, despite the fact that it has one of the worst records of actually reducing CO2 emissions in the real world. And of the 4 points that you could get for actually reducing CO2 emissions effectively, measuring it, performance, they got 0 points.
So this is bizarre to me. How do you end up with ranking second for progress without actually making any progress?
Yeah, it's more about policy than it is helping the planet. Seattle isn't even the worst example. The number one city is New York City, and their CO2 emissions are actually going up. In the study itself, it points out that Seattle's reductions in CO2 emissions per capita, even not just in total, but per capita, are lagging behind both its own metrics and virtually every other city in the study. So overall, performance of Seattle is very poor by their own metrics and their own admission. And yet, because they say the right things and make the right promises, they rank very highly, which I think is the best example we have of the difference between a market approach to reducing environmental impact, where you actually get rewarded for doing good things, and a political approach where you get rewarded for making promises, but you know whether you actually help the planet or not is ancillary.
So does this study then, because it measured both the actual progress versus just, would you put the study in the category of a market-based approach, or is it still in the ideological, we're living in a virtual world, basically, where you think that hope and wishes are equal to actual accomplishment?
Well, it's clearly an ideologically based study, and the points are based on ideology, not on results. Like I said, if they're doing 101 points and only 4 points are related to whether you actually help the planet, it's overwhelmingly skewed toward the ideological preferences of people who wrote the survey. But what happens if you don't actually achieve the goals? Where's the accountability? Look, it's a complicated climate change, CO2 emissions, all of environmental issues, they're complicated. And sometimes you do things that don't work out. That should be expected. It's not a criticism to say that things don't work out the way you expect. The criticism comes, though, if you don't adjust or if you get rewarded for the wrong things. If you keep doing the same thing again and again and getting reward for failure, that's the problem. And that's what this system and that's what Seattle's climate policy has been about. Seattle has missed every single one of its climate targets. It's going to continue to miss its climate targets as long as it gets rewarded for failure.
Yeah, it's a rhetorical question, but it's still fun. I mean, I just find it funny that you can have all of these things lined up and you actually create categories to make up for failure and actual accomplishment. And yet, you know, I would dare say if we went through the city of Seattle and just did man on the street interviews and asked, do you think that citizens of Seattle and their politicians care more about the environment and making an actual difference than people in, say, Houston or Dallas or, you know, name another American city there? Most would probably say yes. You know, I mean, they'd be in competition with Portland or San Francisco or something. And yet, you know, I mean, I've seen this with you before and others. You can point this out and you can tell people, look, there's only 4 of these categories that actually measure improvement. We're failing in all of them. And yet Seattle's giving themselves a pat on the back. And the response is going to be, we're angry at Todd Myers for pointing this out. You know, for telling us that we're not actually making an accomplishment here. I mean,
well,
what's been the response of your blog?
Yeah, King County is the same way. King County released its new climate plan saying that we're going to meet even tougher targets. Well, through 2017, they'd only met 4% of the goal that they wanted. 4%. They'd missed by 96%. And yet, when they did the announcement, the environmental groups showed up, the University of Washington showed up, all to talk about what wonderful leaders King County was on climate change. The United States as a whole has no policy. And yet we have reduced our CO2 emission intensity and CO2 emissions more than King County. So, and yet King County is getting praised for being leaders, and the Trump administration is criticized for being, you know, anti-science. It is totally disconnected from the real world and the environment and what we actually do to help the environment. This is why conservatives need to be more confident on this. Conservatives talk amongst themselves about how much they care about the environment, but they don't say it out loud because they're worried that it becomes a justification for bad government policies. But conservatives need to say, we care, and what you're doing is failing, and we have a better way. And there are lots of better ways that are market-based, that are based on technology and personal accountability, because the way we're doing it with politics in Washington State isn't working.
So you jumped ahead of me there. So what you're saying is the Trump administration has a better record on accident, basically, or at least it's not a policy, but it just by virtue of what they're doing has a better record for carbon reduction, carbon emission reductions than King County does, right?
Right. And what you – the Haas Institute, Energy Institute at Berkeley, had a blog post today where they pointed out that the carbon intensity of energy, how much CO2, you know, comes from energy, and the overall energy intensity, how much energy we use in our economy, has continued on basically the same path as it was from the Obama administration. It's almost a straight line. There's no change. So people have talked about how bad the Trump administration is on climate change, and certainly his messages are very different from the Obama administration. But what's going on is that in the economy, companies and individuals, they don't want to waste money on CO2. They want to waste money on electricity and energy that they don't need. So they find ways to do more with less, to be less energy intensive, to move from high CO2 energy sources like coal to natural gas, which is much lower. And that has continued. Those are the forces that are making a difference, not politics.
Well, that I wish we had more time, but there was a story that was seemed wildly biased to me in the Seattle Times regarding for Native American tribes, this election is an existential crisis, you know, and it starts with a bunch of positive things that the Trump administration has done for Native American tribes. And then it says, yeah, but he hasn't, you know, basically hasn't signed on to the Paris Accords for climate. And then you're telling me that King County gets all the accolades and they're doing less than the Trump administration to reduce climate. But they put out things that get better headlines and they have loftier goals that aren't accomplished. And therefore, it's not an existential crisis for leadership in King County, but it is at the federal level. You know, that's it. It's an Orwellian world we live in, and it's pretty sloppy journalism then if they're not doing the check on these things. Todd Myers of Washington Policy Center, Center for the Environment. Thanks so much for making the time. Always, Todd, you do such great work.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Great story in the Daily Mail. Well, they always have some great stories, but this one is just one of those that makes you feel good. And let's face it, we live in an era and in a year when it's nice to have something that just makes you feel good, right? There's a 12-year-old boy who, to put it mildly, is bright. You know how you've got folks out there that have their bumper stickers on that says, you know, my kid's an honor student. Or, you know, I'm super proud of my my valedictorian. This kid was accepted into Mensa at age 3. He is now the youngest person to study aerospace engineering at Georgia Tech. But he insists that he's really not that bright. Here's a quick synopsis of the 12-year-old kid being recruited by Georgia Tech.
I'm not really smart. I just grasp information quickly. So if I learn quicker, then I can get ahead faster.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's that. But how ahead? How fast? He, you know, he describes having memories at the age of 2 when and then being in classrooms with other kids at the age of two, and he could barely walk. That's when he was in the first grade. He started mimicking his mother's speech when he was 4 weeks old. So
by
here
age
he is,
one,
ABC
he
News.
Was reading.
Yeah.
At two, he knew sign language and how to do fractions.
One, two, three.
I have this distinct memory of going to the first grade class and learning there. Everyone was way taller than me because, you know, I was two. I could barely walk.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a problem for a middle schooler. Can you imagine you're trying to go for scholarships and you're like, gosh, I really want to get that high grade point average because I want to get the scholarship. I'm gonna try and be the valedictorian. Then you turn around and you look and like the 4 year old is outperforming you. You know, at that point you gotta look. In fact, every white supremacist nutjob should get this story so that they could read the story, see this young man, and say to themselves, well, he's not even a young man yet. He's what, 12? See this kid and say to themselves, hey, somebody's been lying to me about this whole supremacy thing because there's nobody smarter than this kid. He also says middle school was kind of a tough era. He might not have been as old as the rest of us, but it was still an awkward time.
The kids there, they kind of looked down on me, or they treated me like I was an anomaly, and which I kind of am.
He is, but I can't imagine. I mean, I think it would have been fun as heck to have that kid in middle school. Just a great story. Well, I posted it on my Facebook page. David Bozin for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM.